I'm gonna roll some tests. You want to say a few more things? How are things in Hawaii?
So far, so good. I've been sending you all the bad news that I'm getting about COVID in the U.S. You know.
Yeah.
I think it's totally underestimated. Totally underestimated. Yeah. So
I mean, we're just kind of, I'm walking around screaming my head off about how overblown it is, and you're thinking it's underestimated. So we're looking at two different realities or something.
Well, I think it bifurcates along these really strict lines. Like, if you're young and healthy, you know, then you're going to suffer for a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's most people. Some people have very few symptoms, but if you get a pretty good dose of it, yeah, you're gonna get a really bad thing. You know, vomiting, lots of headache, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're like 65 and up and you have comorbidities or any kind of chronic condition, which 85% of Americans do, like hypertension, pre-diabetic, you know, metabolic disorder, et cetera, et cetera. This guy is telling me, and I've seen studies, death rate 30% after 60 days.
See, and that's the thing I sort of wondered this out loud a couple months ago, like in August, if this is particularly savage on people who are overweight, obese, which is
definitely
much more of a problem in the U.S. than it is in Canada, although it's a problem in Canada too. But I just think the general sick care, health care, general health of the population is worse in the U.S. And that's why
it could be
that much more devastating.
It's absolutely that way, Mark. I mean, the diet is crap. People are not fit. And then it's so this is like, to me, it's like karma, you know, that all of America's ill health and relying on a profit driven healthcare system, sick care. This is what it's going to lead to.
I really,
and so,
yeah. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
I really wish I made a note of it years ago. I heard it was alternative radio. You know that, what the hell is that guy's name? It was a lecture by a guy who talked about, you know, the destruction of the food system in the United States that came because of monoculture and the incentives to grow crops and, corn. And so everybody was getting, like, he talked about all these dynamics that was pushing people to get the majority of their nutrients from fructose and corn syrup and like this really low quality food, because that was where, because of the wealth inequality and the poverty, it's like that was where they get the most bang for their buck in terms of calories that they needed a day to live.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Jesse, can you say something? And I'm just going to check my sound levels.
Were you trying to reference David Barsamian as the host of the show?
Yes. What's his network called? Alternative.
I think it's Alternative Radio.
I think you're right.
And Jesse, I love your bibliophile background there.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
As you've seen from my emails, I'm kind of like intently focused on the idea that the COVID is completely underestimated in the U.S. And we were just talking about how the poor health of Americans from all the, you know, structural reasons we know is coming back to roost and big time. And then with an age factor, then, you know, and so we were talking about that huge divide, you know, between, there's two realities. The one that you read on Zero Hedge, oh, the death rate's 0.0001. It's like, you know, nobody dies of this. And then I'm talking to people who are doctors in COVID wards saying the death rate's 30% to 70% on sick people.
I mean, like those are the people who got there.
Yeah.
Right? The problem to your original point is there's, you know, the ability to track this thing never existed.
Yeah.
You know, they could have, like, there was a point in like March where if they were serious, they could have deployed the testing regime. And As we know, the White House administration did the opposite, right? That they deliberately didn't want to know. And they did everything they could to prevent the various state-based and federal health authorities to be able to track it.
That's right.
You know, the one of the, I don't know if this has come up on one of our salons, but in my newsletter, you know, one of the arguments I made quite a while ago is that, you know, the issue with COVID is not death, it's disability.
Right.
That if you look at the long COVID, if you, the long haulers, as they're called, the, you know, the amount of people who, even if they had a mild case, they've lost their sense of taste and smell for the rest of their life. Right. And it's remarkable how many people the disease has basically made disabled. And that is something that, you know, has also not really been tracked. But if it was, you know, I think would have changed a lot of people's behavior, because fear of death is one thing, because most people are like, well, whatever, I'm dead, who cares? But fear of disability is a whole other ballgame, because most people, you know, would rather say, okay, yeah, I'll be dead, no problem, versus live the rest of my life with severe disability. Whoa, I'm motivated to prevent that, is what I would expect most people would conclude. But who knows?
Yeah, we're Mark, we're just starting to talk about long COVID and the organ damage and disabilities that are arise in an alarming number of young, healthy people who contracted COVID. And just to add another talking point here, I just was reading a study that the post-COVID healthcare costs of post-COVID patients in Germany, which is much healthier than the U.S. and has done a very good job of keeping their death rate down, 50% higher. In other words, you don't just recover in 3 weeks and then you're done and you're back to your normal life. You know, a huge percentage of people have symptoms of exhaustion and so on. And some last for months, and including people who are young and healthy. So you're looking at a healthcare system that once, if we're going to get herd immunity, which means 200 plus million Americans have to get it, and the healthcare costs are 50% higher on a significant number of the people who recover, what, nobody's even thought about that. And yet it's already real. Those are the facts.
Give me one sec. I should do an intro.
Back, we should tell him he's muted.
Oh. I heard that. I should do an intro before we get too deep into this.
Oh yeah. We don't have to talk solely about COVID. I just think it's kind of like we can be picking up seashells and then not look at the tsunami. But,
is it possible not to talk about COVID in this day and age? I mean, I know there's a lot of COVID fatigue setting in. I mean, I suffer from it and I'm probably not alone, but it is the defining thing of this age, especially now that the election's in the rearview mirror, right?
Yeah.
Access of Easy, salon number 31. I think we're at 31 with Jesse, who looks like he's about to say something right now. Go ahead.
Is the election really over?
I'm
not sure it is. I'm not suggesting we talk about it. I'm just saying, when the guy who in theory lost refuses to acknowledge that he lost, it's not over.
Yeah, I know there's a theoretical legal path, which I've been sort of watching before the media even admitted it was there. But I think a lot of that has been taken off the table already. So I
wasn't referring to said legal path because I'm not aware of one. I was just saying I don't think the election's over, especially because the Electoral College hasn't met yet.
Yeah.
It's premature.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you're right that it's premature to talk about it as over. Having said that, I have been sort of watching what the people who say there's a legal path there and there's a way for it to happen. And I think one by one, a few of those chips have been taken off the table, and I just really don't see it happening. But we live in a crazy world, and how could 2020 get any crazier than something unprecedented like the Electoral College can't certify the election, so it has to go to the House of Representatives, where it's voted on a state, one vote per state basis, where the Republicans have a majority by one or two seats? That's what the people who've been following this are telling me. But we probably don't want to talk about that either.
How are you, Charles?
I'm good. I want to talk about COVID. We haven't really gone into depth in any of the salons yet. So it might be kind of interesting that I think we're at the juncture of, here's my analogy. The water has receded from the bay. And wow, look at all those nice seashells. And we can just walk out there and get them. And so everybody in America is just, most people are walking out there. Yay, look at this. Wow, look at this beautiful seashell. And meanwhile, the most devastating tsunami in recent history is approaching at a very fast clip. And everybody is going to be surprised when it the wave comes in and washes them and everything in its path away. And so that's my sense. And I'll tell you why I feel that. I'm not reading stuff on the mainstream media so much, or the alt media or whatever. I'm getting emails from MDs, physicians, in COVID wards in America. So this is firsthand, okay? And most people, sadly, don't get firsthand information. Everything's been filtered through so many filters to massage the narrative to fit whatever the narrative is supposed to be that's being pushed or promoted. So we that's why we have this great divide that Mark and I were discussing before we started recording. On the one hand, if you look at young, healthy people under the age of 40, the death rate's super low. The vast majority of people recover, appear to have recovered. So it's all like, this is no big deal. If you look at the cohort of people with comorbidities, the chronic illness, and they're 65 or older, the death rate is at minimum 30% within 60 days. And this is from a big study of 38 hospitals, you know, over like 1,500 people, right? And so there's a lot of things to unpack there. And I'll just mention one, time. What I'm hearing from people who are taking care of COVID patients who are dying is there's three pathways to die when you're older or you have these comorbidities. You can die in a few days, you can die in a few weeks, or you can die in a few months, but you're gonna die. Now, nobody's talking about that. And so I think, like, we talk about Hunter Biden's laptop and what can't be discussed. I think the true death rate of people at risk is, it cannot be discussed. Everyone's looking at the big number. Oh, 250,000, that's no big deal. You know, there's 330 million of us, blah, blah, blah. No, that's not the problem. The problem is there's 35 million diabetics. There's 88 million people with pre-diabetic, i.e. metabolic disorder. There's 54 million Americans who are 65 years and older. So that's half the country is at risk. That's 165 million people. And so just the death rates, I can tell you what they are. And this is from studies in Nature and CDC, et cetera. This is not some wild conspiracy site or something like that. These are the best numbers that people have. Diabetic, 7% death rate. Over 65, 11% death rate. Now, and then, with chronic illnesses, those multiply geometrically. In other words, it's not like you add them up like a laundry list. No, it's geometric. That's the way statistical, things work, right? And especially nonlinear. So the death rate doesn't go from 11% with comorbidities to 14%, it jumps to 30% and then to 70%. So I think that's a tsunami, and it's interesting because the divide is very, very, it's almost like a hard line between age and health. And 85% of Americans have some chronic illness, like hypertension or metabolic disorder.
85?
Well, above a certain age.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say somewhere around 50, 55. Yeah, the numbers are extremely high For high blood pressure or metabolic disorder. In other words, blood sugar is not being regulated properly. And of course, that's diet, obesity, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I mean, half the population is obese. And it's just, you know, they say 40%, but then it's like, if you look at the BMI charts, it's like more like 2/3 are actually overweight. And then that puts you at risk of all these things.
To your earlier point of sort of the chickens coming home to roost, I mean, the United States was in a public health crisis well before the pandemic, right? It's partly why Bernie's sort of Medicare for All was such a resonating platform. And it's partly why Obamacare was so contentious, you know, not because people hate healthcare. You know, what Obamacare was a debate over how healthcare was funded and how it was governed. But the fact that there was a public health crisis, I think, was not partisan in any way. It was something that I think a lot of Americans were able to recognize. And it was why there was such pressure on healthcare reform, because that's part of the cause, right? Because so many people, especially poor people, do not have access to reliable healthcare. It's part of why there is such a pervasive chronic illness and pervasive chronic health problems. You know, the diet notwithstanding, because diet is only part of the picture, and diet very much plays a role. I mean, I'm always shocked when I travel to the United States, the kind of food, how difficult it is for me to find healthy food. I mostly just go to grocery stores. That's really the only option I can find in terms of being able to eat healthy, which of course is not easy to do. And even then you're still navigating temptation and all sorts of junk in terms of the way those stores are configured. But, you know, when listening to you, Charles, I was torn a little bit between smugness and humility. You know, on one hand, there was a little bit of that Canadian smugness of, wow, I forgot Charles is American, and he's living in an American media system in which COVID denial has been the norm for many months. And, you know, there was a part of me that wanted to be smug and be like, well, you know, here in Canada, we haven't been so bad. But that's when the humility kicked in. I was like, yeah, no, we've been just as bad. And, you know, Canada is having its own resurgence right now. It's, you know, not as severe as the United States, partly because we do have a universal healthcare system. And the nature of our population being spread out is it does mitigate the spread a little bit versus the density of some parts of the United States have certainly contributed to its rapid spread. But the frustration for someone like myself who, you know, I did most of my writing on COVID in March and April. You know, I was a little bit of rants in May, and then I kind of moved on because, you know, I kind of understood what the situation was. And to see it all come back is a little tiring because I kind of feel it's been there, done that on so many different levels. But that's a mistake because it hasn't been there just because my world and my community and my network has been there and done that. Doesn't mean that everyone else has. And in the last week, as I've been looking at the data in the US, which is flawed, I mean, I think Charles, you and I were both agreeing that there is no way currently to quantify the situation in the United States, that the pandemic is out of control. While there are some data like test numbers, we don't know how accurate that data is because we don't know who's getting tested. And that's also true here in Canada. In Ontario right now, you know, not anyone can get a test. The criteria to get a test is really messed up. And it also means that we don't fully have, we certainly don't have the virus contained, and we don't have a real sense of how it's playing out. But some of the maps and graphs I've looked at in the United States are remarkable because it's middle America. It's, you know, the extent to which the middle of the country, which initially was untouched. I mean, when the first wave of the virus hit the US, it was the coastal regions, right? It was the West Coast and East Coast that were just pummeled, partly because of their cosmopolitan and international links. But now it's the middle of the country that's really getting walloped. And I'm not going to pretend to know why or try to explain it, but it strikes me as an interesting failure to learn from the coast. That had middle America looked at what was happening in New York, looked at what was happening in Washington State and California, it would have been really easy for them to do as Atlantic Canada has done up here in the north, which is basically erect a fortress and not allow the virus in. which is where Atlantic Canada has been sitting pretty, and that they've got near zero currently infection rate. And it's because they're not even allowing Canadians into Atlantic Canada. Like, no way, we don't want you. And, you know, if I was in Nebraska, if I was in Iowa, if I was in a lot of those middle America states, I would have just gone, look, we can keep our economy open, we can keep our society going, but we got to make sure the virus doesn't get in. And because they ignored it, because they were in COVID denial, they're the ones who are getting hit the worst. And that was entirely preventable, which is tragic given the human and health impact that this stuff has.
I get the sense you're both
weigh in here.
Yeah, I'm afraid to weigh in. You know, I mean, like you guys, I was following this pretty early on as well. I was Chris Martinson's show. I was listening to it every day. I remember telling friends and family in January to get some to stock up on food and get N95 masks, and I was stocking up on food and getting N95 masks. And even, I mean, on that note, my understanding of masking, which is almost a whole different conversation, is that it's got to be an N95 or bust. So everyone's walking around with these medical masks on, which to me just keeps reinforcing my suspicion, which I will admit is just a belief, that a lot of this is just theater, in the sense of, like, we're wearing these masks that don't really do any good, but I can't wear an N95 mask all day, but okay, I'll put on a surgical mask and everyone around me breathes easy, and okay, it's just kind of going along to get along in that sense. I mean, I understand the value of, like, it can minimize the odds if you sneeze in large particulate matter, but as far as keeping this out, I don't think a medical mask does it. Jesse?
Yeah, there's overwhelming research that even the basic homemade mask has a tremendous impact.
Okay.
There's videos that kind of demonstrate this. The best videos are ones that are done in cold climates where you can see your breath. And so they breathe without the mask and then they breathe with the mask. And they demonstrate, given that we know this is an airborne virus, that it's not just sneeze droplets, it's like air that transmits it, that wearing those masks has tremendous positive effects. And there's even additional research that says wearing those masks, and I mean like the shitty masks, like the really low quality ones, that they also potentially help you develop immunity. Because, you know, while they're not preventing the stuff from getting in because it's a crappy mask, the way in which it's circulating your breath and feeding it back to you, it's taking that little exposure you got and creating a feedback loop that actually helps you develop immunity without getting the full effect of the illness. So the research around masks, even the crappiest of masks, is overwhelming that it has such a tremendous positive impact. And because of what we now know about super spreaders and the way in which super spreaders are responsible for like 90% of all infection, if everyone wore a mask, we could almost end the pandemic. You know, without herd immunity, without the vaccine, that the masks are so effective at restricting transmission that if we had 100% adoption on masks alone, that the impact of that in terms of ending the pandemic is ridiculous.
Okay, well, I'm going to gently push back on a couple aspects there, and it's not about masks themselves. I'm not an anti-masker. I don't care in that sense. Like, I'll wear a mask, fine. But what bothers me about what's happened is that, and this is kind of why I'm almost hesitant to talk about this at all, is because it's impossible to find out what is objectively true now. So you talked about, hear me out. You talked about a plethora of studies that have shown without a shadow of a doubt that masks are effective. And then some other people that I'm following, I mean, Ivor Cummings out of England, for example, has said, when you review the last 40 years of studies, there's a lot of papers that show for this kind of a respiratory illness, anything under than an N95 is negligible. And then four or five studies have come out this summer that show that they make all the difference in the world. So it's almost an act of faith. What are you going to believe? The 40 years of previous history or the four or five studies that came out in the middle of a hair on fire panic. Hear me out. So the point is, we live in such an information-rich environment that you can find scientific studies that say whatever you want them to say. I want to prove this, or I want to disprove this, and you can probably find a white-coated lab doctor somewhere that's got a study in his hand, peer-reviewed, that supports your argument. I mean, that's what it feels like. So it's impossible to get a sense on this other than, that's all I have to say about that. That probably came out sounding completely wrong.
I think you were very honest and genuine in how you expressed that, and I think the substance of what you expressed is very widely held. So, you know, I disagree 100% with everything you just said, I think that it was a very widely held position that you express with genuine sincerity. And I agree with you on two key points. There's a tremendous amount of pandemic theater going around, and that has completely polluted the information ecosystem, because the public health authorities are so full of shit that you know, when it's difficult, because, you know, and I say this as a obviously huge pro-masker, that the public health authorities didn't recognize the value of masks until well after the fact. So I agree with you that you can go out there and find any information you want to support any position. And that's part of what's fueled the pandemic theater. And similarly, I think that there is a lack of objectivity, I think more accurately, a lack of authority, a lack of central authority that can say this is right and this is wrong. And so we are left to, as in a distributed environment, to find the knowledge, to find the stuff that we choose to believe in. And so the onus is on each individual to use their own thinking skills. And not all of us have the time to wade through the research. Like, the three of us, we are exceptions to the rule in that all three of us are intellectually curious and are interested and capable of looking at this stuff, versus most people are not. So while I disagree with you, because I think it's actually pretty clear and pretty straightforward to find out what is what and what is not, but I agree with you 100% in terms of your frustration that there's so much contradictory information out there. And there's so many quote unquote authorities contradicting each other and saying the opposite things, that it is a free for all. And as a free for all, that makes it a difficult environment in which people can choose what to do or make the right decision.
Charles? Yeah. And yeah, let me jump in with two other points that are well known to all of us. One is to whose benefit? In other words, who's going to profit from me absorbing and accepting this narrative? And I've gotten emails from physicians saying, look, the decision in the US to pursue vaccines was all about profit, because they knew that they could make billions off of that. The alternative, which was what was been taught in public health for decades, is get a cheap test. Get a cheap, fast test. You can put some, you know, litmus paper in your mouth, and then you see whether you're positive or not, because then you can control it in real time, because you have a test that works in a few minutes. Technologically, there's lots of avenues to that sort of test. The US did not pursue that because there's no billions of dollars of profits. So instead, we're chasing this chimera of a vaccine because it's all about the money, man. And so that's when the US healthcare system has destroyed, you know, public health, because it's all about profit, right? And that's why a lot of the research is, you can't trust it, is like, who funded it? You know, and if it's Pfizer, then it's like, well, I wonder why it came out in favor of big pharma meds, you know? So there's that. You've got to find out who's going to benefit. The second thing is public education. And I know I'm probably, you know, an outlier, but, you know, I took physics and chemistry in high school. And, you know, I was pursuing philosophy in college, so I didn't take any science. And then I picked up biology along the way. Just, you know, being curious, like Jesse said. And so I knew about RNA and all this stuff, you know, years ago. I mean, and so it's like, okay, so let's say you're starting from scratch. Well, you still have, if you have any kind of critical thinking skills, then you can take a simple study like the one I saw out of China, And this is what I, this is the my fundamental basis for deciding what to do about masks. They take us a very simple study we can all understand. There's a bus in China, windows closed, circulating air, certain number of people on the bus for a couple hours. One person's infected with the virus. Who else gets it? Very simple question. Very simple, simple scenario we can all understand. It turns out people randomly around the bus got it. The person next to him didn't get it. Anybody with any kind of mask didn't get it. There you go. Now you can read thousands of studies, but you have to have a critical thinking like, okay, where, what do I know about science and what can this tell me about it? You know, and so I think, frankly, I don't know about the Canadian system, but in the US, I don't think people are taught critical thinking, nor are they really taught much about science. I don't think. I think they kind of get some sort of gloss, you know, kind of like a thin layer of crummy paint that's going to peel off. But do they really understand the fundamentals of like scale and dynamics? And, you know, it's like, hey, the immune system's immensely complicated. I one of our friends was getting a PhD in immunology like a decade ago, and she had a chart on her wall. And there's like hundreds of parts to the immune system. So to say, oh, I'm going to understand, no, no, it's impossible. Nobody understands the immune system. All we do is understand some basic mechanisms. But if you do the work to get a, at least that, then you can start feeling your way forward on what do you what do you think about the virus, you know? And so I also fault the public education system. People are trying to make decisions about scientific things, and they're taking opinions that are coming from a point of view of who's going to benefit, right? But if you have critical thinking skills, then you can sort of figure stuff out yourself as to how dangerous this is. And you should go to the source. Like, in other words, you should start reading stuff from people who are in the wards of COVID patients. You shouldn't be reading some columnist who's, you know, selling you something. You know, I mean, it's just like, go to the most fundamental source of the information possible. And there are that. And so it's not that hard to find those. And so to me, I'm just saying those are the things to look at. You got to find out, to whose benefit is this, this narrative I'm being sold? And then go to the very bottom layer of the research, you know? And if you do that, you're probably going to be on the right track.
Can I jump in very quickly with something, Jesse, before you go? One of the things you said, Jesse, and also I did want to call attention to Charles's posts on the work you've been doing on covering the whole vaccine trail and the mRNA virus vaccines, which we'll link to in the show notes, because that actually, I felt better informed after reading those articles than before, and that it's actually prompted me to go do a bit more reading on it. But Jesse said at one point, I disagree with you 100%, and then continue to have a completely civil conversation with me about things and where we did agree. And that hit right there on why I think I have so much combat fatigue and angst around here. Not Jesse, Jesse did the opposite. Is because it has, this entire narrative has become so polarized and politicized. So if you sit around and say, my whole, I guess if I became skeptical at any point, it was because at the beginning of this, I took sort of the model that Chris Martinson laid out and took the doubling figures and the IFR rate and stuff, and I made it into a spreadsheet and showed doubling rates every 15 days and blah, blah, blah. And it just looked like Toronto was going to be a wasteland by the end of June. And then it just didn't happen. And that's okay. But what bothered me was that very few people were looking at numbers, and then when numbers didn't match models, not really asking why these numbers are not matching the models, like the Imperial College model out of England and so forth. And the same thing happens in economics, and it makes me absolutely crazy, where, you know, Paul Krugman will draw model on the whiteboard and say, this is what has to happen to the economy and everything will be fine. And if the policymakers follow his advice, we get the global financial crisis. And then it's like, oh, who could have known? It just drives me crazy. But the way I look at masks is, it's a really low, like, even the people who are other libertarians and anarcho-capitalists and stuff, a lot of them think it's a stupid hill to die on. Because, and the way I look at it is, it's a really low-cost way to pick up some optionality, because people are wrong sometimes, right? So if you do the Pascal's wager grid about, you know, do masks do anything? Do masks not do anything? Do I wear one? Do I not wear one? Like, just the consequences of being wrong are lower if you're wearing a mask. You just have more upside in every potential combination of whether they do anything or whether you're wrong about whether they do anything. So it's just a low cost way to gain that optionality. And what got me thinking more along those terms this summer, because I've been, you know, the COVID years, I picked up finally Annie Duke's book, Thinking in Bets. And I realized, reading that book, how much I think in absolute terms and in terms of this certain outcome is a lock, it's got to happen, it can't not happen, like the inevitability of certain things. And I began realizing that what we're really dealing with are probabilities and scenarios, and some have higher probabilities than others. And the most intelligent thing we can do is to try and look at which ones have the higher probabilities, not make a religious statement on what's absolutely going to happen or not happen. So, I mean, Jesse masks, okay, in his mind, in your scenarios, you would be saying, okay, there's a 95 or 99% probability that this is what's happening and this is how I'm going to respond to it, rather than thinking of it in absolute fundamental terms. I don't mean to put words in your mouth or be in your mind, but I just found that once I realized how much I think in these absolute terms, and then I started seeing it all around me. The other thing I've been doing in the last week is I've stayed off social media and stopped reading certain sites and all these alternative things. I'm done. It doesn't matter if these people are right or if these people are right. There's the only thing I can really do is respond on a personal level and just do what I can to sort of keep myself and my family healthy and safe and just sort of minimize the odds. That's really all we can do, any of us. I don't know if that's making any sense, but
it did. And, you know, I'm going to try to go back to Charles's remarks before I bring them back to yours. But I think in reverse, part of what Charles was arguing, which I agree with, is that if you have a certain level of critical thinking skills, if you have a certain level of literacy, it is possible to, whether it's go to direct sources or whether it's find the knowledge that you choose to trust, it is out there. And I agree, Mark, that it is an issue of probability, not certainty. That, you know, the nature of quantum entanglement is that as soon as you think something is certain, forget about it, it's not. And so I think there is a need to be adaptive and dynamic, but that knowledge is out there. And, you know, I remember in my community where, I mean, there are a lot of COVID deniers here. And I was, at least at the grocery store, I was the first person wearing a mask by at least a month. And I mean the first person in the sense that people looked at me like I was weird. And yet I looked at them sanitizing every surface as if they were weird. Because I knew by then that it wasn't being transmitted by surfaces and that was a waste of their time. And that wearing a mask was actually the best way that you could manage the difference. And that's where, Charles, I think it's important, even though we all indulge in it, to beware of the Canadian romanticism, especially when in juxtaposition with the United States. And it has been happening recently with both politics and the pandemic. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, because the elite in Canada are both relatively small, but because the country's small, are relatively powerful, they project to the rest of the world not what Canada is, but what the Canadian elite is, right? So the Canadian elite is well-educated, pretends they have critical thinking skills, is very cosmopolitan, metrosexual, open to the world. But the rest of Canada sure as hell ain't, right? The rest of Canada is just as working class as America, just as localized in terms of their culture, has everything to do with their lives and their world, and not some national culture, not some global culture. And I think, unfortunately, that's where public education is failing Canadians just as it is Americans. That's where Canadian healthcare is failing Canadians just as it is Americans. I mean, the pandemic here, while it hasn't been as brutal as it has in the United States, its long-term impact is just as devastating. I was reading this week that amongst children's hospitals in Canada, because elective surgeries have either been postponed or radically staggered, that the waiting list right now for children's surgeries in Canada is so long that it eclipses, like you'll have a surgery for like a cleft palate, or, you know, and the thing about children's surgeries is the kids are aging rapidly. So there's usually a very limited window in which that procedure or that therapy can be done to have a benefit before their aging body just makes it impossible or cripples them or makes that issue become even more complicated. And now they're in this paradox where the delay is longer than the time in which that procedure is feasible or viable. So a whole world of medicine is just not possible anymore because the system does not have the capacity to order a surgery within the 2 years. It's even longer in many cases that having such a procedure makes sense in terms of the child's changing body. And that's the tip of the iceberg, right? We're not even talking what's happening to geriatric medicine in terms of people aging and not being able to get the elective surgeries and procedures that have all been backlogged because the healthcare system is legitimately dealing with this crisis. And so, you know, that's where, to your earlier point, Charles, I think the economic impact, if we'll just measure that, let alone the political and social impact of this pandemic, we are still underestimating it. And it is going to be tremendous because of the sheer seismic shift, the tsunami, in your terms, that this is hitting not just the healthcare system, but the economy at large. And I think the other last thing I'm going to say, Charles, is, and this kind of brings it back as well to your points, Mark, that I've been thinking all along, and it's not because I share your frustration, Mark, at both the polarization, but not just the lack of civil debate, the lack of coherence, right? The fact that both sides are kind of, not both sides, all sides, because there isn't just two, there's many sides, and most of them, all of them are incoherent, because I don't think it's about ideology. I think it's about identity. Right. And that if it was about ideology, then at a certain point, the ideas would come to fruition. And to Mark's point, either people would go, well, I'm going to wear a mask because it's low risk. You know, it doesn't hurt me if I do it. I'm not really giving in to the dictatorship by wearing a mask. Right. That's what ideology would lead us to, because it would be rational. But we don't have ideology anymore. It's tribal. It's identity. So it's not clear thinking. It's based on what your peeps are doing. And if they're all saying no masks, you say no masks. If they say masks, you say masks. If they say your opponent is crazy, then your opponent is crazy, right? And that it has nothing to do with rational debate. It has to do with the fervor and zealotry of identity and feeling like you belong, feeling as if you're part of it, feeling as if you're participating in the great epic quest, whatever that quest may be, whether to get masks, or whether to stop pedophilia, which is Q's quest, which is a very noble quest. How can you fault them for wanting to stop pedophilia? That's a legitimate concern. And that we get carried away in that quest for identity, that quest for belonging. And I think that's where the pandemic has become an expression of these tribal sentiments in a way that I don't think as a society we know how to deal with. Although I think in our discussions here in this podcast, we try to hint at it. But this is a much larger cultural phenomena that as a society, just like the pandemic, we're still struggling to understand.
Can I jump in quickly, Charles? Or?
Sure. Go right ahead.
I've been reading Klaus Schwab's book, The Great Reset. So you hear his name around a lot. He's like usually Bill Gates, Klaus Schwab, Illuminati, world dictatorship, one world government, great reset. The Great Reset is the big meme. That's the title of his book.
And just to clarify, this is the guy who did, was it the fourth industrial revolution?
Yeah, that same one. The chief executive, the executive director and founder of the World Economic Forum, Davos, you know. And so I'm expecting to find all of this Luciferian one world government dystopia, Mark of the Beast stuff in there. And I haven't found it yet. I just find a very, we're probably going to get crucified as I say this, I'm just finding very kind of reasonable, like, this is given this, this is the picture, and this is kind of where the world has to go, and it was headed this way anyway, and this is going to be a huge accelerant for better or for worse. And I'm like, I don't agree with everything he's putting in here, and a lot of these tectonic shifts are stuff that I'm not entirely cool with, but he's not wrong about a lot of it. I haven't gotten to the part where he calls for the abolition of private property yet, and if it's in there, I will rail against it with all my heart, but I have this sneaking suspicion that it's not in there. Like, I'm going to get to the end of the book, and I'm going to go, where's the part where he says private property should be abolished? And correct me if I'm wrong, in the comments. But what I sort of started to suspect is that, I mean, a long time ago, I read Alvin Toffler's Future Shock. It came out in 1971, I believe. And I read it when I was pretty young. And what he said was that it wasn't that change was going to mess people up. It was that the acceleration of the change was going to mess people up. And when I realized the things that I had gotten completely out of sorts and upset about in the past few months or whatever, you know, Ticketmaster deciding immunity passports, you know, the government wasn't going to make the vaccine mandatory, Ticketmaster was, and that just, you know.
But hold on, just could we just point the irony?
Yeah.
For Hollywood films.
Right.
And for, you know, like for the dominant culture that we should be rejecting anyway.
But it's also rock concerts and sporting events and everything pretty well. They're a de facto
dominant monopoly. Culture.
Yeah.
Not punk shows. Punk shows are still cash, man.
Yeah. Where was I going? Right. So these are all these tectonic shifts that were probably going to happen over 40 or 50 years, just to pick a number out of a hat, that on their own, in it, they happened in an orderly fashion, wouldn't have made anybody freak out. But because the time frame of all of this has been so compressed and so pulled forward, I think a lot of my angst, and maybe a lot of everybody's angst, is that the rate of change has accelerated past the point where the population at large can deal with it. It's just too much, too soon, too fast. And because I started thinking about, well, if this happens over 20 years, would I be upset? You know, I would maybe grumble, but it's sort of, you know, I don't know. And then part of it, another side of me thinks, I'm just knuckling under. I'm just making a conscious decision to stick my head in the sand. There's five lights, not four. Drink the Kool-Aid just so everyone will just stop telling me I'm a denier, which I never really wasn't a title I claimed to.
But very, very briefly, I mean, I think part of what you're describing, right, is the boiling frog. And you're right, suggesting that in them turning up the heat, the frog feels it. But I'll also remind you, a recurring theme of this podcast is, you know, it's the long con you got to be worried about, not the short time grift.
Mm.
And, you know, where everything in this crisis feels like, you know, it's urgent, it's happening now, big institutional change. Your point about Schwab, and I haven't read the Reset book. I did read the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Not only did I not think it was radical, I thought it was kind of nonsense. Like, he was just repeating the same old stuff that was elsewhere, right? There's nothing to fear in these guys. They want us to think that they're powerful. They want us to think that they're relevant. That's where, you know, and I'm not trying to change the subject because I want to throw to Charles.
Yeah, we got to let him in a sec. Yeah.
Previously, it's still Facebook that keeps me up at night. It's still Amazon that I got my eyes on.
Google.
Right? Like, yeah, like all this other stuff to me is short-term distraction. The long-term threat is the network itself and the way in which these platforms have a different kind of long-term power. So, you know, that's where, yeah, we got to be talking about the short-term policy. Yeah, we got to be anxious about, you know, how the public policy debates, the appetite that people have, say, for surveillance has changed radically. But I still think we got to keep our eyes on the big picture and the long-term, because that's where we can have the greatest impact, and that's where the greatest threat usually tends to be.
Well, you know, I think the Great Reset is a great topic. We have to devote a whole salon to that, I think. And I'll just summarize my view of it, which is it's very well-written propaganda. I mean, it hits all the right notes. I mean, it's really a phenomenally well-done sort of agenda and narrative. But I think it comes right down to the thing we always talk about. I call it not the Great Reset, the Great Divide. Centralization as the solution to everything, that's their side. Our side is decentralization is the key to everything, is the real solution. And so the Davos group is all about, well, we're going to decide what's best for you, you know, biometric measures and this and that. And it's all going to be good because a handful of us are going to control it all because we know better. So we'll tell you what's right and good for you, right? And so that's to me, it's like the last gasp of flailing centralization. But, you know, that's a whole other topic. I want to go back real quickly to two things you guys said. Jesse, you know, you're right that the system is already, at least in the US, the healthcare system's under extreme stress. And so if you have a cardio event like a heart attack, you're not getting the same care that you were a few months ago already, right? You're more likely to die. And I'll put a number to that. There's 110,000 ICU beds in the US, and I think there's almost 80,000 COVID patients already. So it's like, well, who got squeezed out? Well, the answer is everybody else got squeezed out. So, and at some point when you fill the thing with 100,000 COVID patients, then the system breaks down. And so to Mark's point about time compression, you know, I'm kind of forgiving of myself and all of us who kind of took the models that were kind of thrown together, because we really didn't know anything, thanks to the Chinese refusing to share any real information. You know, they had they gamed everything. They locked down information, and so all we knew was this thing was killing tens of thousands of people in Wuhan while they were saying only 500 died. And so it was clearly really deadly. And it's since come to be understood that viruses go through this same progression, right? They evolve to become weaker because otherwise they kill off all their hosts.
I mean, I agree 100%. The Chinese Communist Party deserves tremendous blame and responsibility for the global pandemic, but so too does the United States. Right. And to say, you know, while the Chinese did engage in all sorts of cover up and delay and obfuscation, the United States did as well. Right. Well, and where the Chinese did it earlier, you know, which there's a certain guilt or weight that comes with it. How stupid do you got to be to do it later, to delay and try to cover stuff up after? Let everyone know what's going on. I digress. And
in the middle of that was the World Health Organization that was almost complicit in the Chinese deception. And they're supposed to be like, you get
not
you
almost get, they were you they get were. They were guilty as all hell.
Yeah. And you get kicked off of Facebook if you say something that contravenes the WHO or the CDC. Right. And they were both just like I'm bombasticizing.
Let's not give Facebook
that
any credit. It Facebook randomly kicked you off. There's some things you could say, there's some things you couldn't say, and who knows which was which.
But my point was, even these supposed neutral NGOs that were supposed to be the expert authorities on these matters just demonstrated a staggering level of incompetence and duplicity go ahead.
Let's not spread any propaganda by suggesting anyone's neutral.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so to me, I'm like, well, no wonder. I mean, this whole episode just feels like the great loss of credibility and everything. And maybe that's what the world needs. Maybe the world needs to wake up and go, you know what? the state doesn't know everything. The authorities don't know everything. The media, certainly. We could do a whole episode on how disappointed we are in the media.
But let's bring it back to something Charles said. I think all that is true if critical thinking is pervasive.
Correct.
If people have a high level of literacy. Because the dangerous situation we're in now is we're destroying the credibility of almost all institutions. We're destroying the credibility of most experts and centralized authorities. But we do not yet have I don't want to say an alternative system because that's too much, that's too grand. I mean, even lower scale.
I know what you
we
mean.
We don't have decentralized powers. We don't have powers that are committed to a decentralized network society who are coming forward to say we're ready for this. And to give a few examples, you know, close to home, imagine the internet societies, right? Because these are organizations that I'm fond of. Right. Imagine that they were larger than they currently are, had membership that were more substantive than they currently are. And they started stepping forward saying, forget about these World Health Organizations. Let's talk about Wikipedia. Forget about these centralized systems. Forget about the mainstream media. You know, let's look at what's going on Reddit. Right. And if they, you know, really started to provide not just leadership, but dialogue and public education and literacy that helped, you know, not only shake up the existing system, but help educate people as to their options into the new system, that mitigates our collective fear that instead what's going to happen is as the existing centralized institutions fall, more powerful centralized institutions will arise. And they will masquerade as decentralized. They will masquerade as networks, aka platforms, and say, oh, everyone here on YouTube has a free chance to be a YouTuber. Everyone here can post whatever, you know, and propagate their mythology and their crap, and people won't be able to tell the difference, right? And they'll go right to these new centralized powers and empires because they'll believe that they offer the freedom and alternative that we discuss, but that unfortunately doesn't exist yet. Because here's what I wanted to talk about this week, and I don't mean in the sense of I want to talk about it. I wanted to hear what you particular, Mark, but I'm also curious, Charles, if you have anything to say. It strikes me that Bitcoin is winning right now big time, and that Bitcoin has been a huge beneficiary of the pandemic. And given that we started today's episode with Charles being legitimately dystopian in terms of anticipating where this pandemic was heading, and I share your bearish outlook, it would seem that Bitcoin is the bull. It would seem that Bitcoin, because to build on my recent remarks, because it exists, because of all the things we talk about, Bitcoin actually pulled it off, so it functions, sorta. Bitcoin is the great beneficiary of the pandemic collapse, so what does that mean? Right? What is the consequence of that? What is the political economic fallout of that? I don't know. So I defer to you, fine, learned, wise gent.
You just did that thing that you hate it when I do, that you unleash a ginormous topic with about 45 seconds left in the show. And we also...
It is true. Guilty.
I did it. I cut Charles off practically mid-sentence, so I hope he's still holding his thought. And I will speak briefly to your point towards the sign out. Go ahead, Charles.
Okay.
Well, take all the time you want. We can go over and everything.
Well, I'm just trying to wrap up a few of our mini threads here. One is that in the neoliberal global economy, everything is optimized to the nth degree, right? So healthcare is totally optimized for like a very small number of people who need ICU, a small number of children who need an operation, et cetera, et cetera. Every bit of redundancy and buffer has been stripped out of everything, out of the supply chain, out of the political order, out of healthcare, et cetera. So now that this sort of thing, this COVID arose, it's like it's we're very quickly hitting these limits because the redundancy and buffers have been stripped out because, hey, it's all about making money or lowering costs. And that's the neoliberal agenda. And so We're in these highly optimized systems that have very little play. And that's where we're talking about And I want to just make one more quick point on that is when you reach the limits of a highly optimized and inflexible system, then linear goes to nonlinear. And that's what I'm concerned about. I'm not being bearish because of some number is going to be hit that 500,000 people will die or a million or whatever. I'm concerned because I can see these systems that people think are rock solid are about to go nonlinear. And like, I'll give you what I think is going to happen, which is people in America think they can always go somewhere and they're going to get professional care and that somebody's going to pay for it somewhere, right? Somewhere, somehow. Well, they're now, I think we're getting very close to a situation where Americans are going to go to their hospital and say, I'm sick. And they're going to be said, told, go home and self-care. There's no beds left. And so that kind of nonlinear break, it's like the equivalent of you go to the gas station and there's no petrol. And there isn't any for 100 miles. And that's what happens in nonlinear breaks. And so when the healthcare system fails in America and people are just told to go home and die, people will be shocked because they thought that everything is really rock solid. And that's the illusion that scares me.
And you have every right to be terrified, but allow me, as I tend to do, give you a little more fuel for your dystopia. They're going to go home, but they're not going to do self-care. They're going to go to Dr. Google. And Dr. Google is going to be ready to take them into the bosom of healthcare. And Amazon has, in the last week, dramatically accelerated their pharmacy business. Right? So you believe that the digital giants are already seeing this in the search queries that are starting to trend. So it's not just that the traditional healthcare system will collapse. It will collapse and the digital giants will catch all the pieces, at least the profitable ones, as they start to fall.
But I think what that may be true, but when Charles says the whole system will go nonlinear, they'll get home and they can access Dr. Google because the internet will be down and the power will be out and the traffic lights might not be working. They might not even make it home. I mean, that's when we talk about nonlinear, that's what we... Not if they're on their way from the hospital. But my point is, when something goes nonlinear the way Charles is fearing or saying is possible, it's not confined to one system. But cascades.
Right.
But if anything we've said in this podcast series is true, it doesn't affect all systems equally.
Right.
So yes. The old systems like healthcare and education and maybe the nation state, they will collapse. But the network based systems, the internet, and in some cases, electricity systems, they'll keep going, right? And that's the paradox. That you're probably right about the traffic lights. And, you know, the roads, certainly in places like Michigan, where the roads are already gone to crap, you know, they will be unusable. But you will be able to live in your snow crash universe in which you're still connected to the internet and paying in Bitcoin and, you know, selling your services on the Mechanical Turk and getting your health care from Dr. Google and the automated nurse on YouTube.
And the company store has still got their delivery system.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Well, I'll let you wrap it up, or Jesse. I had my say. I got to use two of my favorite words, optimized and nonlinear. So take it away.
I think we're good to leave it there. Jesse, do you have anything else? All right. Well, like us on YouTube, Dr. Google's YouTube, and Stitcher, and Spotify, and Apple iTunes, and I hope everybody...
And feel free to flame us on Twitter. We did get a critique of our last show on Twitter, and even though we responded, such critique, welcome. Please make them tell us how terrible we are. It certainly keeps us honest.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to be able to, if something doesn't land, then tell us about it. But, you know, the other thing that reminds me...
We might learn more about you than we do us, but we still want to hear about it.
Next week, Dimitri Kafinas from Hidden Forces is coming on, and we're recording it. It's the U.S. Thanksgiving on Thursday, so we're going to record this on the Wednesday, and so look for that on the 25th. We will see you all next week.
because hopefully on U.S. Thanksgiving, you're not going to see your family, but you're staying home and connecting with them on the internet, and therefore mitigating the spread of this pandemic.
Yes, and you can have the... You can have the politically charged, heated conversations over Skype instead. All right. See you next week, everyone.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.